This is Charlottesville Tomorrow, an advocate for our future today. Charlottesville Tomorrow is a nonpartisan community organization working on land use, transportation, and community design issues. Visit us on the web at seavilletomorrow.org.
The Charlottesville Planning Commission spent nearly 2 hours discussing one potential solution to homelessness at a work session held on April 28, 2009. Single-room occupancies are facilities that contain dozens of studio apartments that are made available at a low rent to qualified tenants. The City Council recently directed the Commission to examine whether the city's zoning code needs to be amended in order to allow them to be built here. Charlottesville Tomorrow's recording of the work session begins with Jason Pearson, chairman of the Charlottesville Planning Commission.
Then we'll just move to the single item on our agenda, which is a presentation by Virginia Supporter Housing on single-room occupancy facilities. And before we turn to that presentation, I just wanted to thank Emily Walden for the report and research that she prepared that we had an opportunity to review, and ask her if she wanted to make any comments prior to this presentation.
Give an introduction, because a couple people didn't get their packet. We're having this work session on single room occupancy facilities, mainly because it's a pretty viable option for affordable housing, permanent housing for the homeless, which is definitely something we want to consider in the options of affordable housing. And it's been initiated by City Council earlier this month to create regulations. We don't have any zoning regulations that specifically speak to this unique type of housing, and so we wanted to have something in Charlottesville sort of similar to our bed and breakfast exercise. Hopefully we'll be similar to the same process. But similar is...
Says Ebony. Which is painful.
Just wait to see what we can take you through this time, Ebony.
Maybe you're just wanting that similar.
To
develop some regulations around this specific type of facility specific to Charlottesville. So the first step in that is educating ourselves on these types of facilities. We've asked Virginia Supportive Housing to come to educate us. They're a nonprofit developer. They've done facilities, a number of them, more on the eastern shore of Virginia. So they're going to give a presentation in your packet. I've done some preliminary research. There's some ordinances in there, just general research on single-room occupancy facilities. So for today, we'd like to have them give their presentation to educate us. They've also done some work with Virginia municipalities on helping them write their ordinances. So go through their presentation. Any questions you have, just on various issues related to SROs. We also have Ed Bain here from the Coalition for the Homeless. If you have any general questions on homelessness, I just wanted him here since I'm unable to answer those particular questions if you have those. So the first half is to be educated. Second half is to sort of look through those ordinances and get your preliminary feedback on what you might think is appropriate for Charlottesville so that we can move forward in drafting the ordinance. When it's initiated by council, we have 100, well, the Planning Commission has 100 days to respond. So with that, I will...
One kind of process question.
So as do I.
Is this, is this going to be presented to the Housing Advisory Committee, or has it already? I missed one meeting and I didn't see it on our agenda.
Not that I know of. It could be a part of the process, if that's sort of your request.
It seems like it would have been maybe a good place to start, or maybe a place where we want to delegate to them or get them involved.
Well, that's a good point. We've got our time crunch.
What's the time crunch?
The 100 days to respond. But that can be part of the process.
We've just had it for this month, so it would be the third Wednesday, I believe, May. What my date is.
I had a question more about the process of this evening. Included in the materials that were sent, I think it was the last document was a draft ordinance,
right, okay.
And that's, and I, if I understood the packet correctly, this is your distillation of the research you've done and conversations that you've had internally, that you've produced this as a draft for us to really look at. Is that your recommendation, or is this just a collection?
I don't have an official recommendation as yet. It was just looking through some of the ordinances and something to bounce ideas off of instead of just pulling things out of the air. So right. Focus our discussion. There's a number of things, those things that are left blank that are for discussion. So it's just for discussion's sake and to get you, we've had a sort of preliminary discussion about staff about what may be appropriate so you can get some feedback.
I'm Kim on the street with Virginia Supportive Housing, deputy of our housing division, and Allison Bozanovich is the director of our housing development. And what we'd like to do tonight is take a couple minutes to show you it's a short 10-minute video. When we were going to Norfolk to talk about the zoning for our Norfolk property, we were struggling with how do we help folks around the Planning Commission in Norfolk get a feeling for our properties in Richmond. Some of them had made the trek to Richmond, but others had not. And so this video was produced by a Leadership Metro Richmond group. They did it in a week. They did it very quickly for us. But this was produced to help provide some insight on our Richmond properties and how the neighborhood felt about that. So we'd like to show that first, then talk to you about what it is we do with some information. We have a PowerPoint for that, a copy of which is in your folder, and then finally end up with a real short 6-minute video that will show the property in Norfolk, and it has some residents.
The situation that they're in, trying to do a little better than what they were doing when they were out here. And like I said, basically, if it wasn't for this place and like that, we'd probably still be out there trying to figure out what we're going to do next.
He's at New Clay House, which is the first SRO in the state, the first single room occupancy. Was the conversion of an old brewery. The second one you're going to see is the conversion of an old hotel.
Virginia Support House taking over this building.
VCU
it was an old motel, and it was called the City Motel. It was run down.
It was inhabited at all times by a combination of prostitutes, drug dealers, and drug users. It was 24-hour-a-day traffic in and out of here. There's a tremendous amount of noise, a certain level of violence. It wasn't safe. It was ugly.
And it was not a very pleasant place to say I live near.
When I was first informed that Virginia Supportive Housing was going to be involved here, it was by way of a neighbor expressing essentially alarmed that such a thing would be taking place. They expressed the idea that this would be some sort of a halfway house and that it was going to be populated by drug addicts and sex offenders. And my response to that was basically, it's already populated by sex offenders and drug addicts.
And we became involved. We attended meetings and we were kept informed, which made a difference in our decisions to continue supporting this.
I wasn't really clear on what the organization did, so I made some phone calls and I found out about the facility that's at Clay and Harrison. And I went down there and I did a tour of the facility and I talked to the administrators and came to find out that it was that my neighbor's concerns were entirely unfounded and that they couldn't have been further from the truth, and that the people that were going to be living here were going to be people that were either disabled or were down on their luck and on their way back up, and people that were looking to improve themselves. And it seemed like a fine thing to me and a really good use for the property.
From there, we just sort of pitched in and did whatever we could do to get this along.
When we went to visit the New Clay House when it had opened, I was just amazed at what I saw. The neighbors had bought this facility, but when I went in and I saw the way the security, the way they had a social worker that worked with the folks that were in transition from being homeless back into the workforce. It was really, I saw a support system or something that I never knew existed before. Even 10 years after it had been opened, the place still had it looked like it had opened the previous year. And one of the things that through the years we discovered was that the neighbors who fought this became the biggest endorsers of the project, because what they imagined was going to happen did not happen. But the main thing that people turn around is sometimes the one place is built like this next to them because they get the idea that you either got people, felons getting out of jail, or you've got dope addicts. And they don't realize that sometimes when you get disabled, you could have a good job like I did. And you get disabled, and it takes you a little bit of time, something like 2 years for me to get my disability. If you ain't got no money to pay no rent, until you do get it, you out here.
Once I discovered what the truth was concerning the organization, I was very much in favor of Virginia Supportive Housing moving in here and transforming this place.
I feel that this facility is an asset to the community.
And now there are a bunch of really nice people living here. They take excellent care of the property. It's well-maintained. The residents are respectful and quiet, and they're a fine addition to the neighborhood.
And I think it's very good that they are here and they are accepted and that they're living a normal life.
If I were a business owner and I had a business that was anywhere near a motel that seemed to cater to drug dealers and prostitutes, the first thing I would do, I would be looking for an organization that could develop that into an SRO.
Anyone that has any kind of concerns about a supportive housing facility being established in their neighborhood, to them I would recommend that they contact the facilities that already exist and check them out for themselves.
They should go to meetings and hear the good things and not listen to the bad things that might happen. I would tell the people that would live near a facility that might be built to get involved.
Their fears will be dispelled
because it will be a transforming experience and turn something that was from a real liability into a real asset to the neighborhood.
Virginia Supportive Housing has completely transformed this neighborhood.
I can't see anything that could be more beneficial than have a place like this. And I think this is what we need, places that will keep people off the street, give them a place to feel welcome, a place that they can live and feel comfortable of being back into the community.
I do go to a lot of the city hall meetings, but I try to stress to them why we need some of these more places like that. But yeah, the more they put up of these here, the less people will be out there. They can't put enough of them up. That's part I'm concerned anyway.
That's a really quick introduction to what we want to be talking about, which is permanent supportive housing. And that's what this is. All of our tenants sign leases, and they pay rent. They pay 30% of their income on rent with a minimum of $50. The properties we develop, we are a nonprofit, but the properties we develop are properties that pay real estate taxes. What we're going to do, we've got a PowerPoint in your packet, and we're going to talk through that just so we don't forget to make some of the points that we want to make. We've been around since 1988. New Clay House that you saw has been in operation since 1992. It was the first such development in the state, and we continue to operate that facility. We added South Richmond, the motel that you saw in 96, and worked to develop the nation's first regional SRO with the cities of Portsmouth, Norfolk, and Virginia Beach, combining resources, and opened that one in 2005. We have Virginia Beach. We just opened that one this past fall. And we expect to have Portsmouth, we hope to have Portsmouth, under construction this coming fall. And so that regional idea, that regional concept where communities come together to take care of what is really a region's problem is a concept that we feel has really worked. An integrated approach, which is one of the things I think you heard a couple of the speakers talk about, the service component being very important. We do our own property management, and we have services. And so within the building, our staff offices for social workers, who are trained to provide mental health support services, and also our property management staff. We have someone at the front desk 16 hours a day. Folks can come in and out. They have a key card. And they have their own key to their apartment, but they come in and out of the building with a key card. We have a night manager who's there all night. All of this is to say, this is very much, it reminds folks when they tour it of what you might see in a senior development, where you have an enhanced security system and you have an enhanced staffing level. That's what we do here. And we find that that really helps us with the population that we're working with. Pardon?
Or a dorm.
Or a dorm, although my kids have been in dorms that haven't had quite as much staff. The key to this is the permanent housing and the support services, and we feel strongly that you need both to help folks succeed. We have more than a 90% success rate in terms of the folks that we're able to help move out of homelessness and stay out of homelessness. And so we feel that's really important. We're working with folks at the very lowest income levels. The folks who come in to us are folks who have either zero income or have very, very low income, and many of them have disabilities. We have about 60-65% of the folks that we work with come in with either a physical disability, a mental health issue, or a former substance abuse issue, and those folks are often in need of the service component.
Do you want questions during the presentation?
Oh, yeah, feel free to stop us.
Mr. Cruzier.
My name is Mike Perugio. I apologize for coming in late. I'm on the planning commission. On reference to the 90% of the residents who are not returning to homelessness, mm-hmm. How does that break down? Is that because they permanently live in this shelter for as far as long as you know?
We track people when they leave. When folks leave when they leave and go somewhere else, we stay in contact with them, and we survey folks annually to make sure that they still have an address. And so we verify that the folks who've moved out and moved away are still in permanent housing. They're still, most of our folks, because they're working at very low incomes, we have had a few, you can count them on one hand, who've moved into home ownership. That's not as often an immediate step. But we have folks who move into the private market as their incomes improve and they get better jobs, and they move into an apartment.
What kind of percentage would you say permanently stay in the housing that's provided, or at least as long as it's been open, that this is their housing now?
We have, we'll take a new building as an example. 90% of the folks who move into any one of our new buildings will move out in about 3.5 to 4 years. That's been our experience. They improve their incomes, they stabilize the situations that could be that they had issues with alcohol or substance abuse. Those issues they deal with. And so they're able to stabilize, and they will in 3.5 to 4 years be able to move out.
And just
about 10%.
The national average on that, most Americans move every 3 to 5 years.
Yeah. About 10% of the folks have disabilities that are significant enough. We try to do, the financial folks that we work with want to see about 5% of the units accessible. We do many more than that. We do 10% that are accessible. And in fact, I think that for the folks who've been through our units, all of our units are adaptable. They're all big enough to spin a wheelchair. We feel like the homeless population, as are the rest of us, that age is going up. And so the homeless population will need more mobility as time goes on. We're all going to find that's going to be an issue. So those 10% of the folks who have disabilities are likely to stay with us. And it's been our experience they do for a lot longer. Many of them. We've had a few folks in our new Clay House property who stayed with us until they died. This was as independent a living situation as they were able to manage with. And they were good tenants. And they managed to get jobs that would allow them to be productive. They registered to vote. They did all the things that you want good citizens to do.
Do you provide on-site services to any non-residents?
We do not. We have a financial literacy arm, and we have done budget and credit counseling on-site. That's one of the things we do. And if there are people in the community who are interested in coming in for our budget or credit counseling, we've opened that class situation up. But we don't do, for example, we've not done, we don't do mental health counseling for folks beyond our staff. This is a good opportunity to say, for the folks who come in, we do criminal and credit background checks on the folks, the homeless individuals. Because of the issues with the rental subsidies, we can't have folks who have either who've been either sex offenders or who have a methamphetamine conviction. That's just not permitted. But that isn't to say that we don't have folks who've had some run-ins. If you've been homeless, you've probably found that you've spent some time.
Can you talk about how you decide? I mean, I assume there's more demand than there is supply. So how do you decide who or maybe you're planning on covering this? Or?
Actually, we do. I'm happy to answer. We have far greater demand. We always have long waiting lists. And so we work with referral agencies. We work really closely with the agencies in the community, our homeless service providers. In our, because of the regional component that we have in our Southampton Roads properties, each city has a certain number of individuals, a certain number of rooms or units in those properties. For example, in Norfolk, 42 of the units of the 60 units in Norfolk are for Norfolk residents. And so they give us, there is a single point of contact in the city, and that their office on homelessness will give us the referral. In Virginia Beach, it's the Virginia Beach Housing Office. And so we take the referrals to the city. If we did a regional one in Charlottesville, you would tell us who you want your point of contact to be. It might be someone in your continuum. It might be the continuum of care agency or representative. We're hoping that if we proceed to do one here, we'll also have the participation of other jurisdictions, maybe Albemarle. We would want them to refer their individuals to us. The same thing would happen. We would do a criminal and credit. They would be interviewed twice by the property manager, who's going to want to be real firm about their rights and responsibilities as tenants and what they need to do in terms of being a good community member. And our social work staff are going to see if the individual wants to make a life change and is going to be willing to live in community. And they're going to do a psychosocial assessment to see, in their estimation, whether this person would be a good fit for the community. And then we have to go through all the income verification and everything that would be a part of the rental subsidy process. But for the most part, I would say if you sent 10 people to us, I would say most of the time about 7 out of the 10 or 8 out of the 10 are appropriate. We might find that we have one who, during the course of the interview, presents themselves maybe in a drunken condition or has there's some issue that we think might, they're not ready for this yet, they're not ready to make a life change, and so that might not be appropriate. But I would say 7 or 8 out of 10 of them would come in.
What happens when they violate the terms of the agreement, terms of eviction, they can't pay the $50 minimum, or they become involved in methamphetamines or what have you?
Well, there are a couple of answers to that. We are property managers, and so we have all of the rights and responsibilities of Virginia Landlord Tenant Act. We are also supportive housing property managers. And so your rent is due, even if it's $50 the first of the month. By the fifth day of the month, we have a delinquency list. And we share that. You're getting a note from the property manager that you're late with your rent. That list is also shared with the support services staff. And they're going to see what's wrong. Is it that you had to make a choice between your rent or a medication? You know, what's the issue? If there is an issue, we're going to do a payment agreement with you to figure out how you can, even if it's $50, how can you pay that rent and get yourself back in good standing? What we find we might have to proceed is if we find someone after a couple of months of trying to work out this issue, if they refuse to pay rent, this is not a flop house. Mm-hmm. This is a responsibility. Ride. And it's not a free ride. This is a rental company. And so but there's usually a lot of effort that's gone into place with the support services staff before we, unlike a regular landlord, we're going to go through, you're going to have a lot of discussions with that tenant property manager is and the support services staff. Now, you also asked a question about behavior and drugs specifically. If we believe someone is using, and we have cameras in the hallway, you know, that's purposeful, and cameras in the community. If we have a behavior issue, and sometimes people who come in off the street need to relearn how to live in community, and so if we have an issue, the cameras help with that. If we believe what we see is that there is a drug problem, we always work closely with our precinct commanders, and we will have somebody come in, and we will ask if they'll bring the dogs, and you'll be arrested. And we make that really clear to folks. Now, if you've got it, if you've slipped, if you tell us, we've slipped, I need help, then we work with providers in the neighborhood, our network of the folks that we work with, so we can get you the counseling and the opportunity to, people fall, and so we understand that. But we don't want anybody dealing drugs or doing anything on the property that shouldn't. Get into a fight, and you're both going to get a notice from the property manager on no uncertain terms that behavior is not tolerated. And so we're pretty clear about that. Do things happen within the property? Yes, occasionally they do. Those are neighbors, and to them, they haven't seen things happen, and they don't, which is good. Mm-hmm. We know the warts, and so we've addressed those with folks that, but to our neighbors, to the larger community, they don't see it, and that's good. That's what we want.
I guess I'm less concerned about the impacts than about what happened. It sounds like even if their supply met demand in a way, if you could sort of calculate that. It sounds like it doesn't obviate the need for shelters. There's still also sort of another level of support for those. And do you work with shelters for referrals?
We do. We have a really good. When we meet with our service providers, they are all the emergency and transitional shelters. The problem is for them, we can't build units fast enough because they get bottlenecked unless they can find a place for folks to go. They only have so many beds, and so the issue is, and we can have a waiting list where we have no movement on a unit for 6 months or a year, or it can be a period of time, and so. We work closely with them to sort out when we've got a unit coming open. We always let people know, John got a new job and he's indicated in a couple of months he wants to move. If you've got a good candidate, make sure you're sending them our way. And conversely, for those localities where we have a long waiting list, our property manager's sending letters. Homeless folks sometimes don't stay in the same shelter. So the address we had for you a couple of months ago may not be the address now. And so if you were first on it, we're calling them saying, where Mike Jones is? We're having trouble finding him now, and he's the next one on the waiting list. And so we're talking to our network. And so we're talking to that network. Can you help us find him and make sure? I think the gentleman
you had mentioned before that you would work if somebody were to fall off the wagon or get involved in drugs as far as paying rent. What if it were a situation where someone ended up staying a 3 or 6 month inpatient rehabilitation as part of their getting back on their feet? How do you handle that situation? Do you hold a place for them?
What we've done in the past, if they can continue to pay that $50 a month, or whatever their rental subsidy is, whatever their portion of it, not a problem. If they can't, then we're trying to work with them to see if we can do a payment arrangement. If they can't do it, we work with, we've got a couple of nice churches that are good benefactors that will help us cover. What we want to do is not have that person become homeless again, simply because they wanted to take care of that issue. And so we're going to do whatever we can do to try and keep that unit and that person. Their stuff is in there, too.
Right.
And so we don't want to compromise their ability to success.
Thank you.
I have other questions, but would you like to go through the presentation more?
I wonder whether, I'm curious how long you think the presentation would take without questions versus, because in a way we've covered, I've just been scanning through and I know we've covered some of the topics that you were planning.
Yeah, we're going to go pretty fast through some of these pages. So I think we answered people can stay as long as they want. Yeah, and I think we talked about the on-site case management.
reference to the people that you serve, the next block down there. One of our SCAC report pointed out 232 homeless people now. Would this reduce that number theoretically by 60?
Actually,
right off the bat?
Yeah. What we found in Norfolk, when Norfolk did their point in time count the year after Gosnell opened, they had a decrease in the number of homeless single adults.
Yeah.
That they feel directly was attributable.
Sure. Well, that makes good math sense, at least, and that's great. But what do you find, or what does the community find after that? Do those number that it's reduced immediately or within months go right back up to what they were before? Do they go higher? What's the pattern that you see in development sectors?
I think it's in the future, it's a whole...
really hard to say, because what we've seen in the Hampton Roads area is this last year, because of the economic situation, everybody has been seeing a 7-10% increase in their homeless numbers. So even though we were seeing decreases because our buildings
for a couple of years before,
it's really hard to say now, because
and we're going to have to wait until this situation sorts itself out economically to see whether the pattern of continuing to decline.
If you took that out, because we're sort of an anomaly right now with that, what have you seen historically? Have the numbers crept back up to where they were, or have the numbers stayed permanently lowered once something was done?
We haven't done point-in-time counts. I don't know how long you all have, but in the Richmond area, we've probably done point-in-time counts for only about 8 or 9 years. And so for us, it's sort of...
6, 5, 6.
Yeah. And so it's hard to have that... You know, when you talk about that long-term data, my sense would be that you're always going to have people coming into the system, and we just have the ability to address 60 of them at a time. And so depending on what pressures are out there to push people into this...
Well, give an example, if you don't mind. And you open New Clay Street, and then, 4 years later, you open South Richmond. Mm-hmm. So what were the... you have anything on the numbers that, you know, is there just huge number, and this was just addressing the initial group, you know, with your 60 at New Clay, and then your additional numbers at the...
All that I have is anecdotal. They weren't tracking, they weren't taking community-wide numbers. When it was opened in 92, and the same thing in 96... they weren't doing big counts. The sense was that after they opened the second one in South Richmond in 96, that they had the problem, quote, solved. And we're now working to expand South Richmond. And we'd like to, the homeless service providers in the area would like us to consider another regional one. Now, this is 12 years later. And so, but we've always had solid waiting lists. And so I don't think we solved the problem. You know, I don't think there are enough affordable housing units at this price point and with these services to solve the... I think we definitely put a dent in what people saw on the street. And
in the homeless demographic, the greatest percentage of that is homeless single adults.
By far.
And 60%, I think. And
more than that.
And more than that. And so we're really targeting the greatest demographic in the homeless population. Not to say they're not married, but at this point in their life, they're by themselves. And that's who we're targeting.
Right.
It's also a group that has, there are less services for, at least my understanding is that children and single moms and such that get into that situation are given priority in some of the other services. I may be completely incorrect, but I remember hearing that at a coalition meeting.
I think just from communities at large, we have Caritas in Richmond, and they have the NEST program in Norfolk. And what they're finding is that they have, these are folks who go from, and Caritas goes churches, house folks at night. NEST does the same thing. What they're finding is they're the same people. And so the NEST folks came to speak at the public hearing for the Planning Commission in Norfolk saying, we have the same people. We're getting worn out. We need to get housing for these folks. And I think the Caritas folks in Richmond feel the same way. We need... Now, they'd like to be there for the folks who become homeless, but for folks who are there all the time that they're dealing with, it's a drain on other service providers. So,
anecdotally, for locally, for Potsdam, I've been on the board several years, but this winter we were able to get 13 of the homeless that were coming to the shelters into, you know, housing with help. You know, one of the, we have a fund that puts first month rent and that sort of thing in place. So The numbers are still heavy because of the economic downturn, but yet some of them are moving into, you know, housing where they can qualify for Section 8 vouchers and that sort of thing. So it's slowly getting there, and it's questionable. It's a 232 in point in time count. What's that going to be next winter? Yeah, I don't know.
We have several housing programs in addition, and I'm going to just cover this quickly, but to tell you, we have our single room occupancy is the residentially based program. We also have a program, A Place to Start, where we work with folks and help them provide mental health services and support services to folks who are in private apartments, private housing. That's only in Richmond. We'd like to expand that to the Southampton Roads area, but we're not there yet. It's a new program for us. It's only 2 years running. We have good outcomes, but we need to make sure it really runs before we take it to any of the other localities or offer it to anyone else. We want to make sure we really get that nailed. We are the Shelter Plus Care provider for the Richmond metro area. Financial Foundations is the program that we have doing credit counseling and budgeting, and we want all of our tenants to have that opportunity. And we have a housing resource center. We sort of fell into that when another nonprofit in the area could not do that anymore. And what that really is, you can call this number, and it's not just our housing, it's all the private landlords that we work with that we can try and help steer you to housing. And on the fifth page and sixth page, you've got some descriptions of some of the other things we do. We also have permanent housing residences for families. They're small four-unit properties that in neighborhoods in the city of Richmond that are working on home ownership, they're often problem rental properties. And so that's a great property for us to do, for us to work with families on. It's small, only four families. It's in a neighborhood surrounded by home ownership. We like that idea. That's been really successful for us, for our family partners. And then we work with family, and then we work with individuals and families that have disabled family members or disabilities. We have two houses for two group homes for folks with traumatic brain injury and a group home for folks with HIV and a couple of family apartments. Support services. I wanted to talk just a minute about what that includes. On page bottom of page 7, we're talking about case management. I think anyone who has experience in this will tell you, and our director of clinical services has said to me before, of 60 people in a building, 20 people would be high-end users. They're going to come to see the social worker every day because they need that touch point. We'll have 20 people who will need help occasionally. They need help when they're doing their taxes, when they're doing a job interview. They need help every once in a while. And then we have 20 people who really don't want much in the way of services. They might come if they really had something they couldn't figure out, but they feel pretty independent. And that's sort of the makeup. And so we do have folks that are going to spend a couple of residents and will spend an awful lot of time with the case managers, and others that will choose to spend a little bit less. They're going to get counseling and life skills training. We do inspections of our units, of our apartments. Initially, when you're first on board, you're going to get a monthly inspection. Often, if you've been on the street, you forget how to do dishes, clean your bathroom, take care of your apartment, and so you may need some life skills training. Once you've successfully had a couple of good apartment, then you're on a quarterly basis. That allows us to make sure that behaviors that are sometimes typical, like hoarding, don't get out of hand. You're not stacking the pizza boxes in the corner or doing something that could be a problem for somebody else. Community building. We really encourage our tenants to participate in the community that they live in terms of the building. We have a lot of activities, and they plan parties and birthday parties and all sorts of celebrations. We also have encouraged them to participate in the larger community. And a good testament to how well this worked, when Virginia Commonwealth University, which is just two blocks away from us with the new playhouse, did a leadership program. They were reserving a couple of slots for the Carver community. And the Carver community president called us and said, you know, they had this discussion at their community meeting, and they want a resident from New Clay House to take one of the slots. And so we're really happy about that. We feel like that's a nice testament to the fact that we try to be good neighbors and try to make sure folks are doing what they can do to take care of the neighborhood. Support services, I think the page 8 talks, it sort of lists the mental health support services that illustrates some of the things that we're going to be talking to folks about. Help with the daily living skills and personal finances, health and nutrition, if there's a need to sort out the psychiatric issues and make sure that you get connection and get the medicines you need and take them. I'm going to let Allison just talk
about...
Can I
ask a question before you go on? I'm not sure if I've read it or heard it, but where does the other percentage of the money get made up if they pay 30%?
It's the rental subsidy. All of our properties have project-based rental subsidies.
So how does it get paid? Who pays that?
The HUD, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Through the Section 8 program, through the local housing authorities. And when we work on a regional project, although the housing subsidies may come from different entities, we end up with an agreement with the housing authorities agreeing that one entity takes the lead and is the responsible entity for that in terms of doing income verifications and that sort of thing. As their income improves, they have to report it and they pay more rent and the subsidy goes down.
Great. So let's talk about Charlottesville Project. And I just wanted to make sure we understood the acronym, SRO. We use a lot of housing acronyms. SRO stands for Single Room Occupancy. Basically, what we're talking about is providing a studio apartment with a full kitchen and a full bath. About 350 square feet, a basic motel unit would be a good comparison. And everyone gets their own key, and that is their unit. They don't have to leave during the day. Like a shelter, this is their apartment. There, they sign the lease. We also provide basic furniture.
Can I ask a question about this, Doug? Mm-hmm. It says here that your, your model is looking for communal kitchens and baths.
No communal kitchens and baths. Some in larger cities and older SROs.
That's a national. That was a, when SROs first came into being, there used to be boarding houses. Right. When I think right after World War II, and in the 40s, boarding houses were pretty common. If you came to the big city, until you got on your feet, you might live as a single adult in a boarding house. Well, all of the work that the cities were doing in the 60s and 70s, they took out most boarding houses. And so there really isn't a housing stock in most cities that where there is the ability to have that studio apartment.
I think that's great. I've been a police officer for 23 years. Mm-hmm. Whenever you have, even in Charlottesville now, where we have communal setups, it's by far where we have more problems than when it's separate.
And we found folks move more quickly through the process when they have their own individual unit.
Yeah, I should say, in New Clay House, everybody has their own individual unit. But that one was done in 92. And so we have two communal kitchens, one on each floor. And we swore we'd never do that again. Just from you, just as you described, it's who's cleaning up their mess.
Mm-hmm. Who's stealing stuff out of the refrigerator?
Yeah, we steal stuff. And so that's
and
the only one.
Communal showers.
And as we move to renovate, we're actually talking with VHDA tomorrow about some renovations to that building. That's one of the first things
that's
the property
great.
Manager and services folks want to do.
Great.
Get rid of those communal kitchens.
Can I ask a question? Is that the same reason why you don't have any kinds of houses for two people? And then as you have single occupancy and you have family, you don't have anything for...
It's just not been... We have had married couples before who've come in and they come in and so they each have their own apartment. We're not set up to treat... Because you have the potential of having two incomes, we've just not done that. The largest group of people in a homeless situation are homeless single adults. The second largest group are people with families. It's not that there isn't a need. It's just their numbers are so few. We've just not.
And it's our philosophy that mixing is not a good idea. And we do not want to have our homeless single adults mixed with the families with children.
I'm talking to two groups nationally who are doing that with mixed results, and I'm going to wait and see how that goes. I just think that's... mixing families and singles.
You just don't want to deal with social problems that come along.
I just think that's not a great idea. But we're going to
even putting two people in an apartment is again it increases our cost for service. Mm-hmm.
And you can go in your own place and lock your own door.
And you have your own peace.
Yeah, I just wanted to understand if that.
Mm-hmm. But we had a married couple where we had two, they each had their own apartment. They very quickly, I think within a year, were able to get their incomes up, and they wanted out because they wanted.
It's a good time to mention that we do have rules and regulations for the building, and one of the rules is no overnight guests. And so guests are checked in during the day, and when the desk clerk in the evening goes off duty, they have to be checked out. And so
talk about a motivator.
Yeah.
Can they just let them right back in?
Oh, we have a night manager, and we've got the cameras. And so the next morning, the desk clerk, they look at the cameras. And if you're letting people in, overnight guests, you're going to get a notice from the... I mean, that is a rule that you sign on, and so you risk eviction if you don't let people into the building at night.
Is there, I don't know if I missed something, I don't think I did, but is there a particular project already in mind for Charlottesville that has a location?
We're looking at a couple of different sites. We've not, and this is the, what we've done in all the communities we've worked with, we have 44 sites that we looked at in Norfolk, and about 20 some in Virginia Beach. We want to make sure everybody understands what we're talking about bringing in, and we want to look for a site that offers good access to bus transportation, great access. We'd like to have good access to a grocery store, drug store, and jobs, because that's what we want folks to get. There are a couple of sites that have been proposed, and we're weighing them in terms everything in terms of how close they are to all of that, as well as the cost. We need to have a seller who's willing to wait. And these are tax credit projects. If we found a site today, we'd have to find somebody who'd be willing to wait until September of 2010 to close, to do the final closing. That's a long time to wait. And so we're taking the time now to talk to the community and make sure that everybody's fine as we're looking at sites. But the financing takes... There are state loans and the tax credit program.
And by us looking at a text amendment, what we're basically doing is putting sort of zoning, SRO zoning on the books, so that when a site is identified, if it meets those requirements, we'll be ready to go.
Are you still looking at new construction, or are you also considering rehab?
We'd rather do new construction, because we pay the utilities. And just to give you an example, the budget for utilities in 2008 for Gosnell Apartments in Norfolk, and that's a new building, lots of green technology, $45,000. The budget this year, we're easily going to spend $60,000, and that's money the rents are not going to increase that fast. And so I would rather do new construction, where we always do things to the max in terms of energy efficiency. If you take an older building, New Clay House is a classic example. There's very little I can do to retrofit, other than windows and HVAC systems, in a cost-effective manner. And so my preference would be new construction, to build in those cost efficiencies that will help us maintain the building for the next 20 years.
The last paragraph on the single page we have on the Charlottesville Studio Apartments talks about the front desk will be staffed 16 hours a day and the resident manager will be on call. Mm-hmm. So that makes me think that you're not going to have someone on location.
We have an apartment. They have a set of cameras. They don't have to sit at the front desk all night, because what we found, people fall asleep.
Right.
But they are every night.
So they're in the building?
They're in the building. They reside on the building. And we have a set of cameras.
The one in Virginia Beach, the apartment is right across the door.
If they forget their key, if you've got a tenant who forgets their key, or they've had someone whose health situation got impaired at night, we have an intercom system, and they called the night manager, and we were able to take care of it.
So is that a permanent resident, or is that it's the same person?
Oh yeah, he's
different
he
shifts
there.
During the week.
He lives there. His home. It's for New Clay House, it was a gentleman who used to be homeless. He started working at the Crown Plaza Hotel. He's been their employee of the year 3 years running. But he's also, we consider, a good employee of the year. He's been our night manager for about 5 years. And Orville is great. He really takes care of the tenants and takes care of all the issues that come up at night.
So, schedule. So, as Candace described, at this point we're having what we consider stakeholder meetings, where we're meeting with folks to talk about what an SRO is, while we're also on the side considering sites that have been proposed to us. The schedule here is what we're currently looking at doing, but that's not to say if the site doesn't isn't identified, or if the community decides, you know, we need more time to have meetings and get behind this. You know, this is just where we're working from right now. This looks for us to identify a site this summer, begin due diligence work that would include environmentals, preliminary design work, the zoning work in the fall, and we will be submitting by next March a low-income housing tax credit application. That means in about a year from now, we will be seriously getting all the funding together. These projects cost anywhere between $6 and $8 million. And so we have about a year and a half to get that all pulled together. And we'd hopefully start construction in the fall of 2010. These usually take about 12 months to construct.
Can I ask a schedule question?
Absolutely.
The city charter has a provision that vagrants aren't allowed in Charlottesville, and we have to change the city charter before we could.
But these aren't vagrants. These would be folks who are. They actually have. They have signed a lease, and they are.
So, okay.
They're actually residents.
I see.
With all the responsibilities and rights.
Could you give us examples of stakeholders you've met with and stakeholders you're planning to meet with?
Mm-hmm. We've met with Thomas Jefferson. We've met with the
homeless advisory.
We've met with Region 10 just to talk with them, start some preliminary conversations with them.
Randy Vickers from the Housing Authority.
Mm-hmm. And we have met with Dave Norris several times, Councilman Hooja.
We've been given a preliminary grant from the Charlottesville Community Foundation.
And met several times with them.
Grant with them. I'm sorry.
And we're meeting with people who are interested in the topic.
Various
today,
groups.
Yeah, today we met with Francis Fife and Nancy Irvine because they are interested in housing, and we wanted to talk to them about this and get a sense or a feeling from them. And so we're open to meeting. We'll meet with anybody who wants to talk about this issue to tell them what we're talking about doing, to gauge whether or not these are expensive projects. And we're on the hook. When we sign with these tax credits, we are on the hook for the 15-year compliance period. And they'll come looking for us with the IRS or the tax credit syndicator if we don't live up to the managing the property effectively.
Who have you met with from Elmore County?
Ron White. We've also met with and gave a presentation to their housing committee.
How long has Virginia Supportive Housing been incorporated?
Since 1988. And so that's why there's so much time here when you look at the schedule in terms of meeting with folks and talking with individuals about it. We want to make sure people understand what we're proposing and are interested and willing to be supportive. If you're not, this is too expensive for us to undertake if the community isn't invested in terms of the support.
Have you spoken to any neighborhood associations, especially where you're...
We'll do that when we have a site that's identified. Typically what we'll do, if we close in on a site, before we do an option to purchase, we will contact the neighbors and want to sit down and talk with the neighbors. We've met one-on-one with neighbors before. And our properties in Norfolk and Virginia Beach to make sure they understood what we were talking about and answer any questions. Also see, is there something one of the neighbors for our Virginia Beach property had a question about a fence. Well, that's easy enough to resolve. That was the only question. After we talked about the population, we thought there would be other questions, but it was simply a fence issue. We met with community groups. In Norfolk, there is a community group not immediately around Park Place, which is the community our building was in. But there in Richmond, it's the Fan District. In Norfolk, it's the Ghent. They're not immediately, but they're very influential and they have concerns about what goes on in the city. So we met with the Resident Association and we met with the Business Association. And they seemed comfortable after we talked with them and answered questions And so we would do the same thing here. We'd meet with the businesses and the residents that are immediately impacted And then anyone else who's curious about it or who wants to know.
Are you planning on reaching out to some of the, like the neighborhood associations? What we hear very often is, no one told us about this, no one told us about this.
Well, yeah, we do not want to find out in a public hearing on the zoning that we have a couple of individuals who are very unhappy about.
We've got 17 neighborhood associations, or 19.
We can't tell you we'd meet with all of them. That would be, right. We would meet with the ones immediately around and those that expressed an interest in having us come to their association.
Yeah, I'd recommend
but
it.
But I don't think I would try to meet with all 19. That's,
no.
But
do you envision only one facility in Charlottesville?
How many people?
So this is a zoning 60. To respond to a one-time situation.
If the population having this problem grew over time, you might decide you wanted another one. But right now, when I look at the numbers, I think numbers support one. And we're worried. When I look at it, I'm thinking we're probably looking at 40 SRO units and maybe 20 units that are studio apartments that would be for folks who are not homeless. Because I'd be a little worried that you have enough demand 10 years down the road. So the financing people we talk to, while initially we might have 60 SRO units, we'd want to talk to our financing people about allowing us 10 or 15 years down the road if we didn't have enough population. If there weren't, if it wasn't enough demand, we could still honor our contracts by allowing
people
very low-income service, single service employees to rent and not be in violation of it.
And I'd like to say too, obviously they're interested in moving this forward in Charlottesville, but I think this is something the city itself, apart from this particular nonprofit group, needs to support and encourage. Whether they did it or not, I think that we need to have something in place for this particular sector of the population, which we do not have any zoning in place that specifically speaks to that now. So.
And just to follow up with what you asked about how long we've been around, everything we have developed, we own and manage, and we've continued in operation.
Yeah.
So we take this very seriously. We're signing 30, 40-year commitments on some of it.
I mean, listen, everything I've read about SRO tends to indicate that the management's the critical thing.
Yeah.
And if the management falls through, the project can go to hell in a handbasket.
We have a pretty active board of directors and a committee structure, and so there's a site development committee made up of real estate attorneys and realtors and other property interested folks who, they really question us about our pro formas. And then there's another set of folks that we work with that have experience in property management. That's our asset management committee. And so we do the monthly financials. Our intention is to stay in business and to run have well-run and comfortable.
Are those available like on the internet or somewhere, anybody to see like an annual report or whatever?
Our annual report should be on the, it should be up on the website. Our financials are something, they're all done by specific properties. And so if somebody wanted to see a property, we have a calendar year.
Right.
We just had the 2009s done. They haven't been blessed by our board yet, but the audits are all finished for the, or 2008. But we're happy to, we don't have any findings. If you want to see a property, we can PDF them and
pretty transparent about things.
Yeah, that's.
And I've talked to Portsmouth, Richmond, and preliminarily with Virginia Beach, who all have facilities, Portsmouth is building their facilities. And all the folks there on the housing and zoning part of raving reviews of the particular facilities, the management of those particular facilities, and even going through the process about the amount of background work that was done with the neighborhoods in order to sort of get their ordinances and get those, whether it was a special use permit process or whatever. And we'll continually be in contact and getting more information from those groups that have actually had one and gone through the process.
Well, we were just talking about numbers. The next slide was about the budget. If you all have any questions, please know when we are developing these, we're keeping in mind three budgets. I talked about being anywhere from $6 to $8 million. I think Charlottesville is going to be closer to $8 million. but that would be the development budget. And the pieces that make that up are anywhere from 12 to 15 different funding sources that we are putting, meshing together to make these things happen. Those include federal low-income housing tax credits. We have experience with these. We've gotten funded for every application we've submitted. We also take state and local home and CDBG dollars, federal home loan banks, and money from foundations. That's the development budget. The operating budget is what we talked about with the vouchers. They pay for the operation, the utilities, and the property management staff of the apartments. Those project-based vouchers are as essential as raising the $7 or $8 million. You can't go forward if we do not have a voucher attached to every unit, because that is how we run it for the next 15, 20, 30 years. And then the final budget is the support services budget, and that pays for the case managers who are full-time in the building 40 hours a week. And we are licensed in Virginia Beach and Hampton Roads and Richmond to bill for Medicaid. We have to become licensed here in Charlottesville. And so we look for local support until we get our Medicaid funding or Medicaid licensure, and then we bill Medicaid for the mental health services that we're providing to the residents. We can talk more in detail about funding sources if there's more questions. The remaining slides just show some examples. I'm sorry our PowerPoint, because it's much more effective to see these in color. Candace has some.
I travel with these.
If you look at the one, it's a before and after. It used to be an RC Cola bottling warehouse. It was a Mihai plant where the mayor had his first job in Norfolk. And now, $5.5 million later, that's what it looks like. If you turn the page, what was very unique about this building?
It's a skating rink.
We want to see the floor.
Oh my God, that's
right. Did you go there too?
I think that was it.
College Park.
Yeah, that's what it was.
If you look at the top corner of the slide that says Gosnold opening celebration, you see the mayors of Virginia Beach, Norfolk, and Portsmouth all there on the opening, and they were presenting keys to residents. This project was recognized as the first in the country to have regional collaboration. So it was a real coup to have three mayors all working together. And it was a great day for everybody there. The units, the photos down below are what a typical unit looks like. Same on page 12. And then on the bottom of page 12 would be our most recent development, which was the renovation of a skating rink.
Can I ask you about Second Aid vouchers? So it's my understanding that each unit, there's a voucher attached to each unit.
That's correct.
And are they competing with the general pool of Section 8 vouchers in a community? Or
In the ones we have in Gosnold, and actually we used to have them in the Richmond properties. They were through the Section 8 Mod Rehab Program, nationally competitive funding stream for vouchers. The upside was that they were new vouchers that came into the community. The downside was those vouchers did not allow for rent increases. So from the standpoint of a property manager, the rent increase over 10 years was only 8%. The cost of operations over 10 years had gone up to 25%. Not feasible. Mm-hmm. HUD saw that was a problem and allowed, in October 2005, they allowed for another funding stream, and that was that localities could use a portion of the vouchers that they have in their housing authority for supportive housing if support services were offered. And both Virginia Beach and Portsmouth made the decision that they wanted to do that. And so the vouchers that we have for those properties have come through processes where they converted some of their vouchers to create project-based vouchers. But a voucher that travels with the tenant doesn't work for a property. Like, you'd have to wait, keep it open until another tenant with a voucher came along. Mm-hmm. So you really need the project-based vouchers. I know you all have a high utilization rate for your vouchers here, yeah, and that's an issue. That was a similar issue in Virginia Beach. And so our conversation with Virginia Beach was, do you think in 2 years when the building is open, you could have the vouchers that you need? And they thought about it and thought, yes, if we wait for the vouchers to turn and we have that amount of time, we can make that happen.
But meanwhile, people on the waiting list for vouchers are not getting...
It is a set aside.
There's no other way around that. And there are no new... The Section 8 Mod Rehab Program, there are no new... at the federal level, because we were not alone in having that problem and in communicating it. That was, they were hearing that from people all over the country. There isn't a big opening of those vouchers anymore. And so
to address that problem, we have been talking to both Charlottesville Housing Authority and Ron White in Albemarle, because both of them are sources for potential vouchers to this project.
And we got a sense that Albemarle is open to releasing some of their vouchers for the city?
Yes.
We would like to see this be a regional project where there is a commitment for some capital funds. Homelessness doesn't have boundaries. Right. And so...
But Virginia does, unfortunately.
Albemarle has been very open to the idea, and I hope we can keep continuing the dialogue.
That's what we'd like to do. That would be our hope, because we think this is a really extensive project, and really the success of it would be having the region support it, as opposed to having Charlottesville by itself support it. It could still be done, but it would be a much better project if it's a regionally funded.
Let me ask you if that completed the presentation
good
portion.
Good enough, yes.
Okay. I want to ask if there are any members of the public present who had questions for this presenter or comments.
I'm actually on the Housing Committee in Albemarle County. I must have missed you all at one point. I guess the question I had is $6 to $8 million at 60 units, that would be $130,000 a unit. If it's 350 feet, that's $300-$400 a square foot construction cost.
It includes acquisition. If you have to take the acquisition out of it and all of the soft costs related to the environmental and the architecture and the engineering and the we're running about what is $130 a square foot in construction.
$115 to $130.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're budgeting a whole lot for land.
We've looked at what land has been going for here. We did the same thing in Virginia Beach. It was $1.75 million for the site in Virginia Beach. In areas where the land costs are high, that really inflates your budget.
How big of a facility then? So if it's 130, then that means, I guess, $3 or $4 million of that you're setting aside for land costs here in Charlottesville. Maybe the $6 to $8 million is something that is. I'm just sort of curious.
It would depend. I think it could cost us that along the lines of what we just did our forms for Virginia Housing Development Authority for the project in Virginia Beach. And that the final cost, we thought it would be 7.2. Allison is really tight with money, and ended up at 6.9 million. We had very few change orders during the course of the project. 1.75 million was the acquisition, and then the rest of that was construction, architects. We had off-site improvements, bring water and sewer. There were all sorts of, there are all the issues related to putting 60 units if you don't have the infrastructure to support it.
Sure.
Sidewalks, all of those. So, and so when we're budgeting now.
Candace, are you looking for a 1 acre site in Charlottesville, or how large a site?
We're looking at everything.
We've looked at sites, everything from an acre to
half an acre.
To half an acre, which, you'd be very vertical going up.
Uh-huh.
To an acre and a half. Oh, and I think the biggest one was maybe 2 acres, okay. Something like that.
Are you also looking at near in areas of the county or exclusively in
the
city?
We are, but it's got to be where a bus runs.
Right.
We're limited everywhere we look to making sure we have transportation accessible, because that's how folks are going to get
walkable.
That job.
Right, because there are urbanizing parts of the county as well.
I want to, I'm sensitive to the fact, Mr. Perugia, you're going to have to leave at 6:30.
Yes.
I know that in the course of this work session, we're going to discuss both your work and the possibility of you completing a project here. We're also going to discuss the research that Ebony prepared and also potentially the draft language that she prepared. I don't know whether you've had a chance to review that draft language. I assume you have. My one question for you before we turn to that section of the conversation is whether if you were not the developers of this project, you're not the ones who have completed, and as Mr. Emery suggested, the management of such project is the key. if you were to be, if you in your professional capacity were advising the city about what to put in the code to make sure that we were protected to ensure high quality management of a facility, whether or not you were the ones managing it, is there anything missing from what you see in the code as described? If you didn't have the ability to manage it yourselves and somebody else did?
We made a couple of suggestions that were tweaking suggestions, but I think the direction that you've taken in terms of providing a zoning classification, and then although it's a pain for us, requiring a special use permit is really smart. You want to make sure you have that opportunity during the special use permitting process to both look at the development and look at the developer and look at the manager and make sure that you're comfortable with all of that. And so this is
Some of the comments that we had were more keep it a little bit more open. Don't put an acreage requirement.
The sites could be really different.
You know, don't really let it be that there. This opens the door, but then based on what developer comes to you and what site they come to you with, you can tailor it then to that specific situation.
I had that same comment.
Could I do a little?
Sure.
Intro to the thought and sort of about behind this and go through a couple points. It's right here, second page. And just sort of the things from my research and talking with you all and talking from folks from other municipalities, are just the general things that are particularly important and some sort of tweaks and ideas I've had on this. I think it's particularly important to specifically, in the definition, I probably wouldn't have a, I don't know that it's really important to have an upper limit as opposed to a lower limit just for like building code things. You want to make sure there's enough space. I think it's very important that there be provided counseling and training and those things, and particularly this is for an affordable housing model. There's you can do single room occupancies for various reasons. For parking, I think one space for three bedrooms is consistent with what we have for boarding houses and things of that sort where people don't really have cars. I mean, then the space for employees and counseling services, I thought that was particularly appropriate. For where it would be allowed, I think R3 and above would be appropriate, and all the commercial districts. And we staff went through and looked at the mixed-use districts that were close to transportation, services, and housing, and sort of picked those that were not necessarily like neighborhood commercial. That wouldn't probably be appropriate to put in SRO because it was right near single-family housing, things like that. So had some ideas on, in most of our zones, R3 and above, it would be appropriate. I think initially somewhere between 64 and 87 dwelling units per acre, if we were going to do it that way, we could also just put a limit on the number of units that could be done, which I don't think is necessarily unwise either, because you don't want, you know, if our housing numbers go up, I don't know that you want all of the our services in one place. It might be better to have it spread out, so we could alternatively do it that way. Everybody I spoke to, and sort of similar to what Bill was saying, is that the management is probably the most important piece of this. And so having them submit an operational plan and those type of things are particularly important. What else? Things to deter, I mean, to look at during the special use permit process, like I said, very important to be near a bus route. Very important to be near retail services, grocery store, things of that. These are people without cars. You want them close. You want them to be able to walk. So those are particularly important considerations. With the minimum 1 acre, I just threw that in there just for discussion, really, about whether we want a minimum. I think from talking to the gentleman from Fort Smith, I think they put that in there because they didn't want the conversion of single-family homes. Like, say you had a single-family home and you want to turn it into an SRM. So yes, something to fit, just keep in the back of your mind. Not necessarily for the 1 acre, but how you want to, not that you'd be able to necessarily do that here, but sort of they wanted to think about that. Washer, dryer, 24-hour on-site, similar to the 1 acres. Do we want a minimum number of units Yeah,
I don't think we really talked about this as far as the number of units. It has been our organizational experience that a building less than 60 units does not run.
We're actually one of the the smallest one we have in Richmond, 39 units. We are putting a 21 unit addition on because long term we can't make the numbers work to pay for staff on site.
But SROs in larger cities are 100 plus units. So what we've done is find the fewest number of units that we need to cash flow in the long term. And so that's why you keep hearing us talk 60, 60, 60. We need to have 60 housing units to operate. We think anything bigger is not in the interest of the Virginia communities that we're working in, maybe New York or San Francisco. But
the Corporation for Supportive Housing, they use the numbers 80 to 110. I do think Allison's right, the big cities can support that because they've got a big urban mass and a big urban. It just feels too big for us to put that.
But those are just things to consider if you're thinking about how many units you would like to include in your language.
I know people want to stay in their home communities, but if you had a waiting list in Richmond, would you transfer people Charlottesville?
No, because you would, unless Richmond participated and provided funding for this one. It would belong to the Charlottesville region.
I'm just wondering. The numbers need to work, and we don't have enough population here. We have a waiting list in Richmond.
You're off the line.
We never thought about it. We own it, but we own it with the communities that we've developed it with. And so we just wouldn't think about it.
It's an interesting worst case scenario. I mean, worst slash best case scenario, right? I mean, we don't have the homeless numbers to support the business model.
It may not be that you don't have those numbers, but that you may not have people who are wanting to participate in this particular program.
Right.
That's a good
question.
Mr. Bannon, you have a question.
Well, I'd just like to follow up a little bit on the funding, the ongoing funding. So, is what you're saying is that all the places you have, use Medicaid funding and not local dollars for the support services?
Within the last 2 years just become Medicaid certified. And so we have actually within the last year. We were Medicaid certified last January in Richmond. We saw the funding picture changing. Let me back up and say, we used to get local CDBG public service money in Richmond to support our plus foundation money. To support our support services. We did a lot of fundraising for that. The handwriting on the wall was that the CDBG pot was not getting any bigger, and our partners who do a lot of work in emergency and transitional needed that money. And when we started thinking about it, we realized we could build mental health. It took us almost a year and a half to get through that process to be certified as a mental health, as a Medicaid mental health service provider. We believe in the end we'll be able to fund about 80% of our support services through that vehicle, and we'll dramatically reduce what we need to ask from the local, for local CDBG or foundation money.
So currently in Richmond or Norfolk or wherever, are there line items in the city budget to you?
Yes, there are. The number used to be $90,000 in the city of Richmond's budget. It is now $60,000 for the coming year, and it will be lower as we increase that Medicaid funding gets larger and larger. We are enrolling the residents that we're working with. The same thing is happening, and we just became certified about 4 months ago in Norfolk. We've already enrolled 12 of the 60 folks, and so we're ramping up on that one.
But the only cost to the locality, direct cost to the locality, is for the support services, not for any of the other ongoing services.
That's right.
The building pay for the operations themselves.
And any debt service that we really try to arm twist VHDA and anyone else we can with in terms of the loans, but the rent subsidy, the operations, we pay for any debt service. We don't go back to the communities. That the building has to pay for itself.
We get real estate tax from you.
And we just got reassessed in Norfolk.
In the locality you have now that has several jurisdictions participating, mm-hmm. is there concern from the jurisdiction where it's located in that they're now have social service costs from
the new residents? They knew that going in. They knew that going in. We talked about that from the very beginning. And so everybody, with Portsmouth, we meet with the city reps. Well, we meet with them to talk about the status of what's happening at Gosnell or Virginia Beach. And so they got on board with what's happening in Portsmouth. They know from the beginning. And so before we move forward here, we want to make sure everybody knows here that first year and maybe 18 months, depending on how long it takes for us to get certified.
That's not my point. My point is, and I won't belabor this because I know that I'm taking up...
Actually, let me pause it for a second just to make sure, Mr. Cruzier, okay. I know you're going to leave and you have another question.
Thank you. Good. My questions all the time.
I'm going to go back to Mr. Pearson's point because I really don't know if I got a clear answer from you guys on that. So I've got a couple of opinions or points that I'd like to point out on this. As far as, like Jason said, that if you were hired as a consultant and recommending for the city that we had the best policy that we can have in place so that it would reduce our problems but yet endorse such a project, with that in mind. Under one, when we define single room occupancy, we have stated in our draft, this unit may contain kitchens and bathrooms for both. Would it be your recommendation that the units must contain kitchen and bathroom so that there is no communal?
I mean, we say studio apartments. So
right.
That's what we're building.
All right.
And so your decision, but
and we wouldn't build anything but that.
We would, yeah.
Right. Our community rooms tend to have a community kitchen for use at Thanksgiving and Christmas,
right.
But their units also all have their own kitchens.
Right. And the other part was, which is already the other big thing that I guess I want to mention before I run, is the 24-hour on-site management be provided at an SRO. The rules of enforcement shall be reviewed as part of the special use permit. Is that something that you would strongly agree with as well?
Oh, yeah. We did. We submitted to Norfolk, Virginia Beach, and Portsmouth our building rules and regulations as part of the special use permit. And so it allowed them to see what we allow and don't allow in the building. And, I think it's good to feel comfortable with what you're getting, what the neighborhood's getting, what the community's getting.
Awesome. Can I just say one more thing before I run? I personally am very, very supportive of the whole idea behind this. I say this more for my colleagues, I guess, for you two, but thank you for coming tonight. But I am very concerned about the impacts of it, and that's why I think that if we have a strong policy in place to plan to mitigate the potential impacts, which is what I hear you guys saying strongly through management, and this policy is what does that, and I think that's just so important that we don't let it get... too lenient or watered down so that 10 years from now or 5 years from now we've got to revisit it. So, but thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Mr.
You're very welcome. Excuse me. I apologize for having it to squeeze out.
Late and early.
I missed your comment.
Late and early.
Oh, Mr. Brown.
Yeah.
I'm his bodyguard. That's a good
I have a question that's unrelated to sort of what we've been discussing about right now. Did you give a gender breakdown of the buildings of the projects that you have? Did I miss that?
Might be in your packet. There's an outcomes, and I think that...
it probably has the demographic information on it. And the buildings are really different.
To show demographic age on there?
Yeah. More often than not, in the homeless single population, it's predominantly male. But whether it's 60% in one building or 70% in a building just depends on the local population. And the age. I think we're finding with Virginia Beach, a slightly younger population than we thought. And more folks ex-military. In Norfolk than we would have thought. So the demographic is really different depending on the community.
Are there any other questions related to Virginia Supportive Housing?
Yes. Are there any other organizations similar to you or in competition with you, either in Virginia or in other states around the country?
There are some very good organizations nationally that do this. Most of the organizations nationally that do it would do it in a big city, but it would be hard for them to support coming into Virginia and then providing the oversight. And within Virginia, there are other people who are doing supportive housing, but they tend to do group homes. I think we are the only Community Housing Partners. Years ago, they used to be called Virginia Mountain Housing, if you've been around a long time. Mm-hmm. But they, they transformed the Warwick Hotel in Newport News into an 80-unit SRO. About once a year, they would like to give us the Warwick. More because they say it doesn't fit. They like to do they have an interest in doing other kinds of property. So it isn't to say that somebody else who's an experienced developer might not want to do this and might not do a good job at it. I think the Warwick is really a beautiful project, and I think Community Housing Partners does a great job. I don't think it's something everybody wants to do, or everybody or it fits everybody's niche. This is what we do. We do permanent supportive housing. We don't do anything else. We don't develop single family. We're not interested in garden style apartments. This is what we do. And so in Virginia, we are the only people who seem to want to develop.
I'm not trying to put you out of business.
I'm just saying other folks could develop an SRO. It's whether or not they want to live with it long term.
I'm just thinking this in terms of if we're going to be drafting an ordinance, if there are other organizations that might need different ideas than what you have. Like after Mr. Ferruggio spoke, you said that you might want to have you must have such services in the facility. It might be an organization that provides access to it, their next door to it, or something like that.
And that's a community decision. I think that's the decision that is rightly made at the community level. Do you want folks to have access, or do you want the services on site? For us, in our experience, and the Warwick, I don't think I'm talking out of school. They have services that those services staff don't work for them. They are funded through the city, and they've been challenged at different times with that property because of that. I don't know that anybody on the outside would know that, but we've talked with them at times, and I think it does work. There are people across the nation who make that work. Other models where they partner and that different people do those aspects. It's just something we've not done, and so it could be something you do consider. And there are people who do it successfully.
Thanks. I was looking for some broad information so I can make it open to as many potential developers as possible.
Yeah. I mean, you're obviously very committed to what you do, and I understand that the financing and the economies of this are unique. But do you see ways that a private sector developer would be able to operate a similar, but perhaps larger or smaller scale facility using this ordinance?
That's a great question, and we've had some bites, but when they end up seeing the program,
we've actually talked with folks before. Every once in a while they say, hey, we'd really like to do this.
Be your partner.
We sit down with them. We'd like you to be we'd like to be your partner. They look at the performers and we don't want to deal with all those localities. Right. We don't want to deal with all those foundations. But do I think it could work? I do think you could find a developer who could make it work.
Would they be a good manager?
I was about to say the property management piece, which is key. I would be
and
very
mixing
concerned.
Populations.
The homeowners association don't really.
Ms. Keller, am I understanding your question correctly? Is it possible that the city might receive proposals from developers who saw this as an opportunity within the code for a type of development from which they could generate sufficient revenue to make it attractive?
That's what I'm asking. That I mean, we're
I
here,
don't know, our
and everyone's very sympathetic to your cause and to the need in the community.
Right.
But because we would be making a zoning change, are there
the people that come
things
closest
out there
to wanting to the people who come closest to wanting to see this as an opportunity to make money? Are people who often think they might be able to do supportive housing for students, might.
And we are a university community.
Yeah. Well, but if you define it as having support services, if you define it in a way, it's how you want to define that, whether you want a dorm-type situation or single adult living, it's how you... But the private folks who've come to us have been more interested in... Because if you see it as making money, you've got to be able to do the rents in a different way with less subsidy than we do. the only way you can make money is if your rents can go up with the market. And our rents can't.
Want to make sure you're serving the lowest income.
Right. But that would be what
I answer the question.
Can I ask one more?
Mm-hmm.
It was a great video, and I've heard a lot of great things about your projects. And I hate to be the devil's advocate, but have there been any projects that went poorly or that didn't happen for any reason?
Yes. We had, in fact, the one that we still are in pain about, we identified a site for a veterans project, a very small, we had a supportive housing program grant. We'd done a lot of work with the community, and we ended up with two residents who were very influential in the community who did not want this veteran apartment building, you know, small eight-unit apartment building to go forward. And we met with them a number of times, and then we finally decided we had an option on the property. We had invested money in architectural renderings and environmental. And we sat down with the city and said, we have to pull the plug, because if these people, if we move forward, when these guys move in, these men are never going to feel comfortable. This is never going to happen. And so we pulled the plug, and I think we lost about, I don't know, $60,000 as an organization. But we gave up the site. It cost us money, the option. But we realized those minds were not going to be changed, and they were swaying the public, the community view against the veterans in that, and it didn't move forward.
We would never want to put our residents in a neighborhood where they would not be welcome, and where their chances of success were even less.
Do you know what the specific reasons were that these people did not want the facility?
They didn't want to see, and this actually was said in a meeting, they did not want to see people with disabilities walking around the neighborhood.
It's a maybe.
It was, it was just a...
I like to think we're more enlightened here.
This has nothing to do with zoning, but it's just a question I'd like to ask you. Do you engage your residents in the maintenance and care of the facility? I know that there are some group homes in Charlottesville, and I know people who live near them, and they don't mind having the facilities there, and they welcome them into their neighborhoods, but they say, I feel like I don't have neighbors, because they come inside and they stay inside. They don't go outside and work in the yard, and they don't, you know, do those kinds of things that people do in a neighborhood.
We have in a couple of the properties, we have gardens that folks work, are out in their garden. We do encourage folks to take ownership of the building, and one of the telling things that happen after a building is open is there's a culture that gets created. And so the residents will tell one another, don't drop that paper. Don't pick that up. That sort of that wanting to take care of the building is something they sort of do because they live there. Mm-hmm. And for some of them, they don't want anything to happen so that it doesn't look as nice.
You also employ some residents.
Well, we do. We get, it's a good way to give folks their first job with a good reference. And so we have folks that we work with in terms of grounds and janitorial and that sort of thing.
I've asked a couple times whether there are any further questions for Virginia Supportive Housing, and it seems like there are a continuing number of questions. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is our opportunity since you're here and we have this opportunity to speak with you about it. We also do have a document that I know that we will not have a chance to, in effect, work session in the time remaining to us, but we have time to go through some of this document and identify issues for that we know that we'll want Ms. Walden to look at further. We could spend, probably we have enough time to do that now, or we can continue to have an open conversation with our guests since they're here. And I'd just be curious from the commissioners how you'd like to spend the remainder of the time.
My question relates both to the document and to their expertise.
Okay, so I would suggest that we focus on questions that can benefit from their expertise while they're here. It may mean that...
You all could give me your comment.
Well, I guess... I kind of feel like their presence while we're talking about the ordinance is what would be most important. In other words, if we ask a question of Ebony about a particular... the item in the ordinance, we get a perspective both from a planner and also from a potential developer, and it seems like this would be a unique opportunity to have both of them in the room while we talk about the one thing that we actually can act on, which is the ordinance. I would suggest that I'm getting a little anxious that with only 20 minutes left, we're going to lose this opportunity
to focus questions on
the ordinance,
on the issues that might benefit from
on the definition and the ordinance.
Yes.
I'm curious if you know of any Virginia locality ordinances that have, and whether it's possible under the Virginia Code to have any sort of performance standard for the people who are operating the facility. Because once we grant the special use permit, I mean, that's the end of the line for us.
I'm not familiar with any performance standards.
I mean, so you guys could theoretically bail out. Like,
yeah. We were working with...
you wouldn't want to.
We were working with Norfolk, because they were really the first people to want to do an ordinance. We looked at stuff around the country, and at the time we were doing it back in 2004, we didn't see anybody with a performance standard. It doesn't mean they haven't put one in since, but we didn't see anybody that had that.
Mm-hmm. We'd be the last one who would be able to do that in the state of
Virginia. Yeah, I mean, probably not, but, you know, it's just...
Well,
so that's critical,
in effect with the conditions. Are that if they're ever in violation with their conditions, then they'll have to come into compliance, or their special use permit will be revoked, and they can't operate the building.
But I would say that there are two sort of things here that I see as a question: the enforceability of two items that are in this ordinance, and I know this is just a draft, and I don't want to point them out, but I think to Bill's point...
I think it would be important for you to point them out.
Well, I just didn't want to drill down that much, but on page 2, I guess it's F, the developer applicant must require the resident to complete lease success, you know, complete a series of assessments. I mean, that's great for programming, but that's impossible to enforce by our zoning officials. Reed Broadhead's not going to want to be reviewing whether these people are doing their jobs as assessing there. So
it takes us where we were on the B&B, where all these things were very nice theoretically, but when it came down to it, we couldn't write them in.
Yeah. And I guess rules and regulations sure reviewed as part of special use permit. I mean, that could be moved to A, frankly, to A, one of the things that's reviewed perfunctorily, but. And I guess 24-hour on-site management, that's probably fairly enforceable to check into that. But I always worry about conditions that are not enforceable whenever we grant a special use permit that are really tailored to a specific applicant instead of...
I don't think that would be tailored to a specific applicant. Every municipality that I've looked in, and the people that I've talked to, that has been the single most requirement, not specific to Virginia Supportive Housing, that this type of housing... The most important part is the on-site management. That's what makes it work. And I think that even if they weren't here, that needs to be part of this ordinance. It's the most important part of keeping the impacts from the neighborhood and having it well run and having, you know, part of the B&B ordinance was that they need to have somebody on site to be there. And so I don't think that...
When it comes to monitoring...
Pause for a second. I just want to make sure, Mr. Rosenblatt, you had questions, and I want to make sure that we don't skew too far off of them.
Thank you. Yeah, I do have a couple of questions regarding some of the potential restrictions that are listed here, and I realize this is almost kind of a laundry list of restrictions, and we sort of pick and choose, but there were two that jumped off the page at me, and so I wanted to ask Ebony questions about them, and I would also welcome your input as to whether you actually do feel like these things would be so restrictive as to limit your ability to find a suitable piece of land that you can afford. And the first one is the idea that a facility must face a public street at least 50 feet in width. Well, can you give me some examples of a street that's 50 feet in width and
Dale Avenue.
That's required for a lot to be subdivided, that each lot has at least 50 feet.
It wasn't the street, it's the parcel has 50 feet fronting on the right lane, perhaps it could be
I'm sorry, I read that and saw that it basically had to be on a main road.
The policy was on the parcel having to be 50 feet long.
Right.
That's just in our subdivision.
That's where I
But it could be. I got this somewhere else, but it could frontage. Be. I think it should face a public street because every development needs to face a public street and have access to it.
So it must place a public street. Your intent was it must face a public street and have frontage of at least 50 feet in width.
Well, I mean, but that's not true if it's a part of a PUD, for example. It doesn't have to have frontage. If it's condo-wise, it doesn't need to face a public street.
Everything needs to face a public or have access to a public street.
Access, but facing is a weird word. I would say a front or.
Well, not necessarily.
It doesn't have to be the front of the building, but it has to appear to be.
I mean, like I don't know if you think about this, but the X building, just say there were a part of X that could be developed for this.
Right.
And maybe it would be a part of the X building that would be further away from the public street. Would that eliminate the possibility?
I'd have access to public street.
Right, I think access is
good. Yes, that would be much better.
So the public simply must have access to a public street. Is sort of
more so no width requirement at all. Pipes then would be okay.
Is 1,200 feet to, sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
My second question is about no more than two SRO facilities may be located within 1,200 feet of each other or another SRO, another facility, extra word. There's an extra another there. But seems to me to be a little odd and potentially exclusionary. I mean, because it doesn't seem to me to deal with the effects that need to be mitigated. In other words,
minimizing clustering, though.
Right. You don't want all your facility, and 1,200 feet is closer to a quarter mile than I could do the exact math of a quarter mile, is that you don't want all your facilities in one place because of the potential impact. So if you had another facility, you wouldn't want it right next door.
But doesn't impact have to do with number of residents rather than who the residents are? Because if you just simply classify...
Well, I think it has to do with the facility itself and the type of facility it is. So if you had, most of the time you're going to have one, at least 20 or so residents, so... It's just so that there's spacing in between them, so you're not having all these.
I thought we saw some examples of in Richmond, for example. There were in was it the Cary? I don't remember.
One on the north side of the river, one on the south side of the river.
Yeah, and that there were some smaller units that were for four families or something like that.
We just call those supportive apartments in SRO. The comment I would make on this is that we choose not to go into single family neighborhoods, and actually that's where I thought you were going with the facing a 50. I actually read that also to be a public street that's
right.
50 feet. We and I would encourage you to think about not wanting an SRO development in a single family neighborhood. It just isn't a good fit. And so
that's it's not even the proposal.
Yeah. But in proximity, you get into those questions when you're looking about financing as well. There are some dings you take with public financing if you are in a census tract where you're adding to the poverty level of a census tract where you're adding. And so We didn't see a problem with that.
But I don't understand what the difference is between 160 resident unit and 230 resident units within a third of a mile of each other.
The point of it is this, if you just don't have a clustering of SROs and say, what's my mind, 10th and Page, if they were all sites in there, would you want all the SROs for those exact same units? It's already a low-income neighborhood. Would you want to put all your low-income housing in that particular neighborhood, and do we want to allow that, or do we want to say, sure, you can have one, but they need to be about a 5-minute walk apart. 1,300 feet is about a quarter mile, which is about a 5-minute walk, which I think is appropriate to be apart from these type of facilities, and for the community to know that, I think that people have NIMBYism, whatever, to know that one particular area or neighborhood would not be targeted for more than one of these particular facilities.
I understand that, but I think it has more to do with density than...
Maybe doing some wording with, you could have two buildings on a single site that were part of the same development, I guess you didn't even move in that.
Well, I think that we could go on discussing it. That's my
definition of
facilities. That's my recommendation.
Yeah, I don't know.
You don't all support
facilities needs to be right.
Facilities implies an institutional structure, perhaps more than a physical presence.
But it sounds like Ms. Walden's response to your question is clear, Mr. Rosenzweig. Her logic is clear. You're not sure that you agree with the logic necessarily, since in other places one could get 60 residents of an SRO in a single place. If it happened over if you managed to get those 60 residents in a place in the city over the space of 2 years, because two different developers came in and did it as 30 and 30, the ultimate result is the same. Ms. Walden's recommendation is, if you have an opportunity to split them up, you want to. Your perspective is, if we're going to allow 60, why don't we allow it over 2 years rather than over? See, am I fairly characterizing?
Yeah, that what needs to be mitigated is I agree with you, the cluster of poverty population, but I don't think. Sorry, I think we're using. I think this is the wrong regulatory tool myself, because you could theoretically have 3, 4. Of 20 units or 25 units, even though the numbers don't work out for you all below 60, might work out for somebody for another provider under 60, or two providers under 60.
And maybe you want to think about an or that has that density issue that you, it depends on what you're comfortable with,
right,
in terms of density within a quarter of a mile or within 1,200 feet.
You can make this a consideration for granting the SUP as well, proximity to other.
And I mean, a 60 building unit on the size, I mean, that's going to be pretty high density. I mean, we're definitely going to be working with something that we don't work with regularly, with, you know, 61 bedroom apartments. Yeah,
right. What I'm saying is that we're not dealing with just one applicant here who's proposing a 60.
Right.
We're potentially dealing with applicants who might come up with something of lower density, and by restricting it this way, we're not dealing with density, we're dealing with something different.
We're dealing with use.
That's all I have. Thanks.
Okay.
I wonder why you recommended it must have at least 60 units. And again, I know that that's what makes your numbers work with the services you provide. But, I mean, I noticed of your 4 completed projects, only one had, well, 3 of them had.
We
haven't had over 40.
We have one that has, the oldest one has 47 units, and it, we're no longer cash flowing on that one. The second one has 39 units. We're going to add 21 units. Same reason, not cash flowing. The third and fourth ones that we just, the one we opened in Norfolk, the one in Virginia Beach, are 60 units. And when we run those performers
each,
out,
60
units each,
right,
they cash flow. This was not something we, was sort of something we realized as we were 10 years into the first one and 5 years into the second one, and we were planning these. We thought, we can't plan small because we can't. We're having to fundraise for those two buildings. That doesn't make sense. They ought to be of a size that they can.
So I think along Dan's lines of thinking, again, we're looking at an ordinance that isn't just tailored to Virginia's
right. Yeah, that's right.
And I don't understand why a minimum. Maybe there is, just maybe there's a minimum financially or
we had actually talked about this, Candace and I, and we said don't put a minimum of 60 units, maybe 40 or 30 units.
Yeah.
If you didn't want a block house type scenario.
A lot less than that. But I'm just wondering what the public policy reason would be to put any minimum.
If you don't put, I think the challenge, but if you don't put any minimum, would you have a lot of them? Could you have a lot of them? And you were talking about the difficulty with doing any sort of local monitoring. If you have a lot of them and they don't have a public subsidy, we're monitored. You know, we have VHDA coming in and we have the Housing Authority coming in. We have lots of folks who monitor us because of our funding sources. But if you had a private developer who didn't have public funding sources, you might not have those entities coming in to monitor. And so if you have difference, if your sizes are too small, how will you know that something's not being run well until you have a problem in the community?
if the government doesn't tell you, you have a problem.
VHDA will pull our financing and the housing authority will pull our vouchers.
Yeah, I'm not completely convinced about it either. It seems to me that is one thing to balance. On the other hand, if you had 100 of them at 4 units each, in some ways that's even more healthy. Even if some of them are rogue SROs.
Yeah. There probably is a breakpoint, and actually I would ask you this, to really anybody in the room, there's probably a breakpoint below which it's really a boarding house, because you're just, I don't know, I'm not sure, but maybe not.
Or a therapeutic cottage.
Well, I think really have supportive services. There's a number by which it doesn't make sense to have on-site supportive services if there are four such facilities.
But we've seen that happen in other places with the Innisfree facilities and building a bridge. I mean, they operate very small facilities and have someone on site. They may not be the same person, it might rotate, but they are sort of that model.
I think, I guess from my perspective, I feel like there are many possible solutions to the social challenges we face, and challenges of homelessness, challenges of social inequities, mental health and physical disability challenges that our community might face, and there are lots of possible ways that they could be addressed. My sense is that there's a type of solution that has emerged over the last 20 years called an SRO that has a typology. I mean, it has a typology of practice, has a formal typology of roughly how big it is, how it works, and that we as a community are contemplating including that typology of practice and physical form in our community as a way to address some of our challenges. It doesn't preclude us also thinking about other ways to address those social challenges, but my sense is that what's before us is this model of practice that's developed, and I've looked at these in New York City, and I've looked at them on the West Coast. And it has a pretty clear typology of how you go about it. And that's what we're considering here: is do we want to introduce this into our community as a community? And if we do, what do we do from a planning perspective to get it to happen? Not precluding that there might be other forms that we might want to address, but my sense is that's kind of our question. For this discussion, at least. I'd welcome pushback on that as well. I mean, I'm not saying this is the way.
Council's made it clear that this is to be studied and something to come forward, so mm-hmm. that question's partially answered. Mm-hmm. It's more, what should it look like and what fits us best?
Right. I guess my point is that what council has asked us is to look at that typology of practice called the SRO, and that there are other typologies of practice for serving different types of needs, but that isn't what has come before us. It's really the quest. Look at SROs and how we would accommodate them, and they are of a certain size. I mean, and that's what we're trying to accommodate, is that type of practice. That's my sense, anyway.
I'd like to ask a naive zoning question. since
we're responding to a request of this organization and to the need that we have in our community, is there any other way? I mean, we're looking basically at this point at one facility. Is there a way that we could respond to this as a rezoning for a particular site rather than providing this capacity across several zoning categories?
Rezoning for particular. I still don't think we have regulations that really speak to, say, parking. Mm-hmm. And things, I don't think that we have those particular regulations or management of that. We can't just say, we don't have a special use permit in place for an SRO, so we couldn't say do an SRO, so we need something. Whether they went away, and it could fall apart tomorrow, and so we want to make sure
someone
else can.
I think Jenny's thinking
about
the SRO zoning.
Is there a way that someone could come in with a concrete proposal for a particular site and a particular use and request a rezoning, so that we would be dealing with a discrete project rather than something that may distribute and scatter around many neighborhoods?
Well, this, yeah, everybody was getting to this. The use is not something that we have clarified. Exactly.
Because we don't have it.
It's not a permitted
use.
It's not precluded. You can fit it into some different categories, whatever you're saying. It doesn't really fit well. So the parking would be, one per two bedroom would probably be more parking. You wouldn't be able to require on-site management and those particular things because it's not even a use for which we can require a special use permit. For in a rezoning, you really, unless it's a PUD, which they wouldn't do, it's for the use. So you're saying we want to rezone this property for all these particular uses, not particular to this particular type of facility. So what we want to do is allow for this particular type of facility because we don't really have anything in a place that sufficiently addresses it. So they can't come in with a rezoning.
It's a kind of social zoning that we don't normally engage in.
Well, and that's why it would be a special use permit.
Yeah, and that's why. Mm-hmm. While I'm sympathetic to the use and I'm not at all opposed to it,
we're
dealing with apples and oranges. We're dealing with the land use, and then we're dealing with a socioeconomic condition.
Mm-hmm. So there are two things I would say. Just I'll channel Mr. Ferruccio and his support for this and his argument that, from his perspective, it's appropriate for us to be doing that. I think if he were here, he'd be saying that this is the appropriate path to take. I'd also comment that I think a lot of our zoning categories presume a kind of sociological pattern that when we say R1 and we say residential before it, it's presuming a certain sociological pattern as well as the land use and the activities and such. It's a relatively specific form in this case, but it's...
But we could have a very low-end R1 and a very upscale R1. And here we're zoning for a particular class of people. Economic.
No, we're just allowing for a use that's not specifically...
Yeah,
it's the same thing with the B&B. Didn't really speak to it in zoning, so if you wanted to do one, you were kind of confused. Same thing, if they wanted to do one in Charlottesville, you'd be kind of confused, and so some of the regulations wouldn't particularly work for the type of facility that they want to do. So it's allowing for a type of facility that's just not called out at all in our zoning ordinance.
Right. There's no
particular regulations that speak to the social aspect and the particular impact that may occur from it.
Yeah, I'd be a lot more comfortable with it if there was something in the comprehensive plan that sort of dealt with it. I mean, it seems like we're going to the zoning code level to address.
There's in the comprehensive plan. It's in our consolidated plan.
SRO and because I think it's sort of a big step that we're sort of going straight to writing an ordinance, pretty much tailored for one management group. And I'm not sure that I've really read a lot. I mean, for instance, one question I have is we're really interested in density. Would this Are there any one-acre sites that are within the infill SUP line in Charlottesville? And, I don't know. That's sort of a neighborhood development question.
Would we want to require these to be in the infill SUP?
Is there any guidance in the comprehensive plan about that?
I would feel much more comfortable if I knew where we were going to be applying this.
I think that would be more inappropriate because this is allowing for a particular use somewhere throughout our city. You don't really want to look at a particular site because then you would be evaluating the site based on, what the regulations are. And although we have them here to help inform our discussion, I think that we need to be thinking about this as this is something we want to allow in our community, whether we do it or not. I think that we need to take their consideration as if we would take any developer's consideration as we would take, the B&B people who run B&Bs as we took into their consideration their particular needs for those particular type of uses. And they came and they spoke at our public hearing and provided us with information. I think that we need to take that with a grain of salt and look at how we want this to be in our community. And I would imagine it would fit some of their criteria, but this is not necessarily zoning for, we're zoning for use, not necessarily zoning for them.
With that comment, I want to say that officially, it's now 7 o'clock. I don't want to hold people beyond the time, but if you're willing to spend a little bit more time with those who are interested answering questions and further discussion, I think those who are interested would really appreciate that opportunity.
these recommendations will be coming before us in the public hearings, and we will have public hearings, we'll have more opportunities for discussion. But this was a great opportunity for us to have you here and have an opportunity to speak with you about it, and we really appreciate that. So thank you very much. Okay. I will have to leave, but others are welcome to stay.
We'll stay as long as we have questions you want to ask.
I think my card is in most of those folders, and if you felt like your questions weren't answered tonight or you didn't want to ask it in a public forum, feel free to call.
Ms. Lewis, I'm sorry that you feel your questions were not asked, but I was diving in on other people's questions,
but that's okay.
Well, then I'll wait.
I'll probably just maybe send them to Ebony and consult with them if there's a reason to. Okay. Laundry facilities, I don't think we should need to require that in the zoning ordinance. I just think it's
well, the details
we actually currently have them in our zoning ordinance, and they're required in multifamily.
In multifamily. Yeah. But they're called out, like how many are required?
Yes.
I thought it was interesting that your laundry facilities are communal, but your kitchens and baths are not.
No, laundry facilities in the facility, not in the unit.
Right, if they're communal.
Yeah,
we have laundry rooms, three laundry rooms, and 60 units.
A lot of apartment buildings.